Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Kendi Osman. I head up the tax-exempt nonprofit practice here at Ropes and Gray in Boston. And I'm joined today by Aaron Kucher from Grant Thornton. Aaron is a managing director in the nonprofit healthcare and higher education practice at Grant Thornton. And we're happy to be here today for another installment of the Fundamental Series. Today's topic is taxes for tax-exempt organizations. We have a lot of slides. We've got 47 slides, and we've only got an hour. So we're not going to be going through every slide in great detail today, but this is really intended to give more of an overview, and you will have these slides for reference. The BBA will send out the deck after today's meeting. And as was just mentioned, please feel free to use the Q&A function for questions. We'll try to answer them either on the fly or at the end of the program, depending on how things go. So we'll dive right in. Here's the agenda for today. The first real point is, why are we having this session at all if all of these organizations are tax exempt? Why do we need an hour session on taxes? Well, while Section 501c3 organizations usually are exempt from tax on all of their income, the federal tax exemption doesn't automatically shield an organization from all forms of taxation, and that those are some of the items we'll talk about today. Specifically, we'll go through the federal unrelated business income tax, then, and I'll do that piece. Aaron will cover the big bulk in the middle of Massachusetts-specific taxes, both the unrelated business tax, property tax, and sales tax. And then we'll wrap up with a couple of other excise taxes on the federal level, specifically the IRS intermediate sanctions rules and a newish executive compensation excise tax. What we're not going to cover today is the very specific excise tax regime that applies to private foundations versus public charities. That is the subject of another fundamental series. The endowment tax that is specific to colleges and universities, that won't be covered either today. So we'll dive right in by starting on the unrelated business income tax. So key requirement for any Section 501c3 charity is that the organization needs to be organized and operated exclusively for tax-exempt purposes. But we know from the IRS interpretation of exclusively that it actually means primarily. So some amount of unrelated business activity is tolerated, and we'll talk about what the definition of that is in a moment. But before we get to that, understand that if too much unrelated business activity is engaged in, such that the organization really can't be considered to be primarily operated for tax-exempt purposes anymore, then tax exemption could be lost. We are often asked the question, how much unrelated business activity is too much? How much unrelated business income is too much? Well, the IRS says we will not answer this question. There is no percentage limit. There's no numerical calculation of how much is too much. It's kind of a, we know it when we see it, facts and circumstances situation. So while the big penalty would be losing tax exemption if you engage in too much unrelated business activity, short of doing that, the organization is subject to tax on that income. So the basics. So tax is imposed on the unrelated business taxable income, often referred to as UBTI or UBIT, of a Section 501c3 organization. The definition of UBTI is your gross unrelated business income minus the deductions that are directly connected with carrying on that particular trade or business. So there is something called a siloing rule, which is somewhat recent, which basically says you need to take every business that's engaged in on a business by business basis and calculate your unrelated business income. The tax rate that's applied to that income is for tax-exempt entities formed as corporations is the corporate tax rate and the trust rate for exempt organizations that are formed as trusts. And the origin of these provisions is kind of interesting. Back in the late 1940s, the NYU Law School was given, as a charitable gift, all the stock in the Mueller Macaroni Company. And the Mueller Macaroni Company therefore paid all of its profits over to NYU. And at the time, the tax rule was that as long as the destination of that income, the ultimate destination of that income, was for a tax-exempt purpose, the organization was not subject to tax at all. So we had a non-taxable pasta company. So Congress came in and said, no, no, we need to level the playing field. So all macaroni companies will be on the same footing and therefore impose the unrelated business income tax, which is determined not based on how the income is used, but instead on the activity that gave rise to the income and whether that was unrelated to tax exempt purposes. So that goes into what are the elements of unrelated business taxable income. First of all, you need to have a trade or business. It needs to be regularly carried on and not substantially related to the exempt purposes of the organization. So we'll talk about each of those a little bit. So trade or business is generally, you know, it's an activity that has a profit motive. That is, it kind of comes down, boils down to that. But it includes any sort of activity with business characteristics. It could be sale of goods. It could be provision of services. But if there are persistent losses, for example, that will often not be regarded as a trade or business because it tends to show a lack of profit motive. So that's the first requirement. Second requirement, the activity is regularly carried on. So if it's something that's really sporadic or intermittent, that is generally not going to be considered regularly carried on, such as a one-time sale or an occasional event. But where we see most of the activity in this space is the third prong of the test, which is not substantially related to tax-exempt purposes. This is very much a facts and circumstances test. So in order to show that the activity is related and therefore not subject to UBTI, what the organization needs to show is a causal relationship between the business activity and actually achieving the tax-exempt purpose, that it contributes importantly to the accomplishment of a tax-exempt purpose. So back to the Mueller Macaroni example, just using funds from the business to generate income and cash to apply to tax-exempt activities, that's not enough to make an activity related for these purposes. So there's an interesting principle called the fragmentation principle in this UBTI framework that basically says you can have a bunch of different activities going on, and one, they could be within sort of a general charitable activity, but you can pull out or fragment to take an unrelated trade or business and treat one of those activities as an unrelated trade or business. So, for example, you have an educational journal that is produced by an organization. That's a good educational activity. But if there's advertising within that journal, the advertising activity is going to be treated as a separate unrelated trade or business. We have the monastery and the casket example here on the slides. This often comes up in the context of bookstores or museum shops, where you have some sales that may be considered related to the tax-exempt purpose and some that are pulled out and treated as unrelated. So it can be a very tricky and area that requires a lot of analysis if you're trying to figure out which business is related versus unrelated. These rules, however, have many, many, many exceptions. And so when you're working with these rules, it's really important to be digging into whether an exception might apply to what you might assume is an unrelated trade or business. So for example, there's a volunteer exception where if the activity is being carried out entirely by volunteers, it's just not considered an unrelated trade or business at all. Like the bake sale, for example. There's a very important exception for hospitals in particular, and also for universities, which is called the convenience exception. So if an activity, a business activity, is being carried out primarily for the convenience of an organization's members, students, patients, officers, or employees, that's also not considered an unrelated trade or business. So classic example would be the hospital cafeteria. And then another exception is the sale of merchandise that where substantially all of it has been donated to the organization. That's often referred to as the thrift shop exception. So those types of activities are simply not considered an unrelated trade or business at all. And then there's another set of exceptions, which are really exclusions from UBTI. So the acknowledgement that maybe this was from a trade or business, but this particular type of income is simply not treated as UBTI. The really, really big one here is the first one, the passive investment income. So dividends, interest, royalties, rents, annuities are generally, there are some exceptions to the exception, generally exempt from UBIT. This comes up a lot in investment activity, especially investments in partnerships or LLCs that are taxed as pass-through entities where an exempt organization invests in a partnership like an investment fund and generates this type of income, which is often exempt from UBIT. Another big exception is gains from the sale of property. That includes both short-term gains and capital gains. Again, this arises often in the investment context. Keep in mind, though, that if an organization is selling inventory, that is not an exclusion from UBTI. Few traps for the unwary, just to sort of lodge them in one's head. And if you hear something about one of these things, maybe think way back to this webinar and say, I think there might be something that we need to look at further. Big one, debt financed income. So if an organization borrows in order to generate income, that is almost always going to result in UBTI, even if it would be a type of income that would otherwise be considered that good passive income, for example, like dividends or interest. If, for example, an organization borrows to make an investment that would otherwise generate income that would be excluded from UBTI, the borrowing transforms that otherwise good passive income into debt-financed UBTI. There is a special exception for universities and their supporting organizations with respect to debt financing real estate. But otherwise, this is a red flag. If there's borrowing, you'd need to think about whether there might be UBTI. Another thing to keep in mind, joint ventures. So I had mentioned investing in a partnership. If a tax-exempt organization is entering into a joint venture, particularly with a for-profit joint venturer, so forming an LLC, for example, it is possible that some of the income passed through that joint venture to the tax-exempt partner will be UBTI. This is often the case when it's operating income from a business. There are rules around when you have UBTI, when you don't have UBTI. We've put the citation for the revenue ruling that's pertinent on this slide. So just keep in mind, if you have an LLC and you're representing a tax-exempt organization, that's a UBTI flag. Another one, S corporations. So while long ago, tax-exempt organizations couldn't be shareholders in S corporations, they can now, but if they do invest in S corporations, it's 100% UBTI. That's with respect to distributions or allocations, as well as on exit on the sale of S corporation stock. And here we get into some of the exceptions to the exception. So interest, annuities, royalties, and rents, not dividends, but those categories of income that are received from controlled entities So more than 50% owned by a tax-exempt parent. Those are going to be, usually, you have to read this section of the Internal Revenue Code that we have cited here, but usually those are going to be UBTI, even though interest, annuities, royalties, and rents are generally excluded from UBTI. This is a special rule for those types of income from controlled entities. And then the last one I'll mention is rents and royalties, which are generally excluded from UBTI if the exempt organization provides substantial services associated with generating that type of income. That's going to taint the income that would otherwise be good excluded income and make it UBTI. This is like concierge type services that are provided in connection with the receipt of rents, for example, or a bunch of services associated with a license agreement. So how do we, if we have UBTI, what do we do? How do we report it? If an organization has gross income of $1,000 or more from a regularly conducted unrelated business, then it needs to file the Form 990-T with the IRS and pay the tax associated with it. Important to note that the Form 990-T is a publicly available document. It wasn't always that way, but it is publicly available. However, only the attachments and supporting documentations that relate to the calculation of UBTI have to be publicly disclosed. There are lots of other things that are often attached to the 990-T, so that's just something to keep in mind when you're advising clients on what they need to make available to the public. So I think now we are going to switch over to Erin and talk about some state rules.
Great, thank you. So yes, I'm going to talk about some of the state rules, and we'll start out with a continuation on unrelated business income and talk about its taxation in Massachusetts. A little over 40 states tax the unrelated business income of 501c3s and other exempt organizations, including Massachusetts, following the same federal rule. If you have at least $1,000 of federal gross UBI, which includes Massachusetts source UBI, you are subject to income tax in Massachusetts. So this is important to remember, not only dealing with organizations that are domiciled in Massachusetts, but also organizations that might be in some of those partnerships or other exposure points that expose them to state tax in Massachusetts, even though they might be domiciled elsewhere. They might have exposure to the collection of Massachusetts unrelated business income or a filing responsibility as such. Massachusetts does conform to those silos that were mentioned. Massachusetts over the past few years has worked to revise its filing to incorporate the silos similar to the federal return. They are referred to on the Massachusetts return as Schedule E, which is the equivalent of the 990-T Schedule A. The aggregation and adjustments for state tax purposes roll on to the first page of the return. So as I mentioned, Massachusetts subjects unrelated business income to tax for those activities that have nexus to Massachusetts. For example, you know, a Massachusetts organization that operates a hotel for unrelated purposes in the state, but also either the investment income of those in Massachusetts or that flow through income that might come from a partnership investment that is doing business in Massachusetts as well. Those organizations that are domiciled in Massachusetts are subject to what's called a throwback rule. So certain passive income that is not subject to tax in other states will be subject to tax in Massachusetts. The Massachusetts filing itself is a bit cumbersome in that Massachusetts requires the electronic filing of all returns, and it's done through the Massachusetts Department of Revenue. Revenue website. Because this is a smaller filing for Massachusetts, they don't provide a schema to your typical software providers. So everything has to go through the website. So if you're a practitioner, sometimes it can cause an additional level of complexity to assist clients as you need to walk them through how to enter this information onto the DOR's website rather than and carryovers are permitted for 20 years and capital losses can't be carried forward or back. So basically what we see in Massachusetts is a mix of some federal conformity with state adjustments as well. And just keep in mind that this is all for corporate taxpayers. We'll talk about trust taxpayers in a little bit. Due dates for the return follow the traditional calendar for corporate taxpayers. So the fifth day of the fourth month, which is different than if you're familiar with the 990 and 990T, which is the fifth day of the fifth month. The fully extended goes to a month past the federal filing deadline. So we use the example here of December 15th for a calendar year taxpayer. There's no extension required unless you are having a payment with extension. And remember, in order to have a valid extension, both federally and in the state, you have to pay your full liability by the due date of the due date of the return. Some taxpayers are also subject to quarterly estimates as well. We've noted the form here, but really all these payments and all this activity has moved to the MassDOR website. So the form itself is in the website itself, and everything has to be done electronically. This is just important to know, both from an organizational aspect and also, you know, for practitioners, that you want to make sure that organizations are set up for electronic payment, both in the federal and state level, especially for small organizations. Sometimes this can be a challenge and they're not used to this level of electronic payment requirements. We can move to the next slide. So I mentioned all those rules were for our corporate taxpayers. Massachusetts has a separate schema for the taxation of trusts. And actually pretty unique to Massachusetts. I think a couple of other states do it. Massachusetts does not subject 401A trusts, so your pension profit sharing plans or 408 IRAs to UBIT taxation in Massachusetts. A little benefit for those Massachusetts pension trusts to not be subject for UBIT here. They are subject to UBIT on the federal level and in 35 plus states. In some cases, some exempt organizations may themselves have a form of organization as a trust. If you do, there is a different form, the 990T62. What distinguishes and is favorable to those nonprofits that are organized as a trust is that you're allowed a full charitable offset against unrelated business income in Massachusetts. So for example, if the organization had significant UBIT from investment activities, but was engaged in granting activities for other public charities, it can use that activity to fully offset its UBI, something that is not available under the corporate tax rules. And again, is, I'd say, very advantageous from a Massachusetts taxpayer standpoint, and something maybe to think about in formation if you when you're looking at the setup of a new organization and if you expect to have potentially large UEI, for example, from investment activities. Just again, noting estimated payment deadlines here as well. LLCs, they are treated with federal conformity as a pass-through entity unless they be treated as a corporation. Obviously, filing Form 1023 causes an organization to be deemed a corporation for federal purposes. So we go back to those corporation rules when we're looking at UBIT for LLCs that have status as a corporation. Massachusetts, the thing I'll note here with LLCs is that many organizations, and we'll talk about in the property tax section as well, sometimes organizations will use LLCs as a strategy to isolate activities or to isolate certain purchases. Use the single member LLC to flow up under the organization itself. So there's no separate filing for a disregarded LLC in Massachusetts. That's required if you treat it disregarded at the federal level as well. And this just notes exempt unincorporated or association are not treated as a corporation either. This M9, again, use of the M990T 62 for exempt unincorporated organizations or a multi-member LLC and charitable amounts, reducing taxable income, same as the rules for trust. I will say that I don't see this come up as much. Usually the LLC is used, usually incorporation is suggested, and usually the LLC is used as a disregarded LLC, which doesn't require a separate filing. And again, all these filings are prompted by the presence of UBIT as well. So that's a very broad overview of the UBIT section. I'll just say, just from a general sense, from a practitioner's perspective, Massachusetts continues to try to focus on, like I said, conforming that UBIT filing and getting additional information about unrelated business income. Myself personally, and from talking to other practitioners, I haven't seen a lot of audit activity or similarly from the Mass DOR, just something to note. In the UBIT space. So with that, I'll move on to real property tax exemptions. So when we're talking about real property tax exemptions, we're talking about something that happens at the city and town level. We're looking at whether a city or town will grant the property tax exemption. And going back to that concept of the single member LLC, we note here there's some case support that the single member LLC can't not qualify for the property tax exemption itself, even if it's regarded as a C3. So again, something to think about when the organization is structuring purchases and the like. So next slide. So there's an initial application for property tax exemption that's filed, and then the 3ABC is the document that has to be filed by March 1st each year for the exemption to continue to be considered. This is a pretty manual process. It's a package that's put together to disclose to each city and town, requires its own Form 3ABC. So it's important to keep an inventory of where property is located and what towns you need to file for. We note here it has some supporting documentation, including a listing of officers and also how you're using the property and how it fits into the exemption. It also, I think I talked about on the next slide, it requires a copy of the Form 990 to be attached as well. But generally, because of the timing, you'll use a previous copy. I haven't seen much pushback from cities and towns on the use of prior filings as part of this package due to timing considerations. This slide just outlines some of the considerations of what's considered a charity for property tax purposes. So it's important to look at the definition separately than just an overall definition for the organization's exempt purposes, that the actual use of the property fits within the definition of charitable under Massachusetts state law to receive the exemption. We can go to the next slide. This is just some case law, and we'll distribute these slides so you have some support to look at in talking to clients or in your own organization's use of property, that the use of the property itself is supported as a charitable use of the property. Maybe we can go on to the next slide. Again, more support on charitable as well, just to give you for your records. And this is specific support for conservation organizations and looking at whether the property tax exemption requires the charity occupy the property for its charitable purposes. So just something to keep in mind when you're looking at particularly for conservation organizations themselves. Next slide. And then this just talks about all personal property. So that's when I talk about inventory, things like cars, where are they located, in what town are they garage, and then real estate actually owned by the charity for its charitable purposes. So it's just important to know where things are happening, especially in large organizations, so you're able to inventory and report properly. Next slide. And then there is some leeway for 2 years after purchase, and if you're buying property and then leasing it out to third parties, that property is not going to continue to work for the property tax exemption. Keep going. And then there are specific rules around religious organizations, and religious organizations are they're not required to file, but you can file an application to establish and abate the tax. And I'll just pause there on religious organizations too. There's something, they're not required to file 990, but I'll just just because we're on here on religious organizations, a lot of them right now might be interested in looking at potential credits associated that the 990T is used to utilize. So it's important when talking to religious organizations to not forget that some of them are subject to the unrelated business income rules, or they might have other reasons to do a tax filing. I think sometimes we think religious organizations, no filings. They might have reasons why doing a filing might even be beneficial for them to claim certain credits. So just a little stream of consciousness there as an aside as we work through here. Next slide. Okay, maintaining the exemption. Like I said, the 3ABC goes out each year. It's a big package of paper that has to go to all the towns. You have to have it in by March 1st. It has to be there by March 1st, and you'll put the package together to support the exemption. And next. These are just some key dates related for that. Pilot payment. So, you are getting a property tax exemption in relation with your charitable property, but pilot payments, also known as payment in lieu of taxes, are kind of way to still continue to support the city or town where you're located. They are not a tax payment. They are a voluntary contribution, and they might come through not just as payments, but other activities as well that the nonprofit uses to support the city and town in which it's located. Every once in a while, you'll see pilot payments come up as a hot topic of discussion. Especially you might see them bundled with, the takeover of a certain property, a purchase by, for example, a college or university, or just as revenue sources become tighter, you'll see focus on non-for-profits paying their fair share as it relates to it. A lot of towns will make recommendations, including the city of Boston, as to what pilot payments should be. The city of Boston actually has a report out too on what it receives as pilot payments. I have a lot of organizations when they file 990s who specifically in their granting section talk about their voluntary pilot payment as a grant to make sure there's visual and eyes on what they contribute to their local town as support. So it's an important thing just from a public relations optics perspective and good neighbor perspective to focus on with your charities as to how they're meeting their payment in lieu of taxes voluntary obligation. Let me go to the next slide then. Mass sales tax. So purchases by 501c charities are exempt from state sales tax if certain exemptions are made. There's no blanket exemption on the sales side. So charities are responsible for collecting and remitting sales tax. There are some exceptions from that, but something to think about depending upon the charity's operations. It's important to note every state has different rules on what's considered a sales tax exemption. So we in Massachusetts have an exempt purchase exemption looking at the charity. Some states have it depending upon what's being purchased by the charity. So it don't just assume because you have a sales tax certificate in Massachusetts that the item won't be subject to sales tax in other states. It's an important consideration as charities kind of open up their operations beyond their state of domicile to make sure you have a handle on this. Next slide. Exempt purposes, exempt from sales tax. There is a sales tax exemption. Again, this is just the support for the exemption itself. We'll note here. And then this is just the requirements. The purchase is used in the conduct of the charity. Purpose for the organization. The organization must go through the Massachusetts Department of Revenue and obtain an exemption from tax, the form ST2, and then you provide the vendor with an ST5, which certifies how the property is going to be used in the exempt use. So the vendor needs to receive support in order to exclude the exempt sales tax, the exempt purchase from sales tax. Next slide. And then this is just an outline of retaining the document, the certification. It's an online registration. The charity has to mail into the DOR its determination letter. So there's sometimes, a lot of times, there might be some back and forth around when the organization is concurrently obtaining exemption. There's some guidance for that, and it's valid for 10 years for the organization.
Right. I would note there, Erin, as well, this middle bullet point about, you know, when your application is pending, especially now when it takes so long for an organization to get its determination letter from the IRS. This is a really important point because you actually can get the sales tax exemption in Massachusetts when your application is pending with the IRS, which is critical for some, particularly for some small organizations that really rely on that exemption.
Yeah, great point. Yep. And then building materials can be obtained. You just have to work with your contractor on that. Again, also with, you have a purchasing agent as well. So there is a way to continue to use your exemption when you're working with a contractor or other third parties. Some of you might have run into that buying kid things for your kid's school, right? using that exemption. As I mentioned, there's no blanket exception for sales by charities. So they're subject in their, if they have a little convenience store or a bookstore, they still are subject to collection of the sales tax and have to register and remit accordingly with the Department of Revenue. Again, talking about charities growing their footprint, there is, some of you might have heard in other contexts around the Wayfarer case. So if you have sales into other places, but you have no physical presence, you still might have a requirement to collect and remit sales tax, depending upon the laws of the destination state. So it really goes to what the destination state laws, and I know a lot of charities will do an annual inventory to review where they're selling to. For example, if you have a college bookstore or something that's run directly by the college, they'll kind of look to see in what states they're selling items and if they're meeting any threshold for nexus of activity. Next slide. And then exemptions, sale of clothing, sale of admission, sale of publications. And the one we're going to focus on for a second is just casual and isolated sales, which is probably one of the most used for organizations that don't traditionally engage in that. So fundraising activities, exempt. Sale of fundraising purposes are exempt as casual and isolated sales. So if you don't make them in the regular course of business and are used to further the organization's exempt purpose. Just a general note around fundraising activities. This isn't the only consideration of fundraising activities. You want to think about other requirements that come in if you're going to engage in some sort of fundraising activity, particularly things like auctions and casino nights might come with headaches well beyond the consideration of sales tax as well. But it's generally a facts and circumstances, but if you're holding one-time, sales, you should be okay using this casual and isolated sales exemption. Next slide. And then just listing a few factors, whether it's in retail, whether you're ordinarily engaged in it, and whether the proceeds itself are unrelated business taxable income. Next slide. And then charity auctions, if they are also considered casual, isolated, and again, it's not in the regular course of business. You're just, again, trying to focus on, are these non-reoccurring? Are they infrequent? If you just kind of want to look at the totality of facts and circumstances and continue to evaluate those as to whether the activity is subject to sales tax. But if you're doing something as a one-off fundraiser, you shouldn't have any issues with sales tax themselves. Next slide. That might be it.
We're back to the federal side. Okay, that's great. So we're going to flip back to federal, and we're not going to talk about income tax or property tax or sales tax, but instead a couple of important excise taxes that apply to tax-exempt organizations. The first one we're going to talk about is Section 4958 of the Internal Revenue Code, which are called the Intermediate Sanctions Rules or the Excess Benefit Transaction Rules. And basically, this code section imposes an excise tax on what's called an excess benefit transaction, which we'll define in a moment, between a 501c3 organization and a disqualified person, another defined term that we'll talk about in a second. The tax is imposed on this disqualified person in an amount of 25% of the excess benefit. It's a big increase. It increases to 200% of that amount if it's not corrected within a specified period as determined under the code. There is also the possibility that an excise tax can be imposed on what are called organization managers, which is generally the board, if they knowingly approved a transaction, knowing it was an excess benefit transaction. That is a smaller tax, 10% of the excess benefit, up to $20,000 per transaction, joint and several liability. In order to correct an excess benefit transaction, it has to be unwound. So the excess benefit needs to be repaid to the organization. And importantly, as I just said, with respect to talking about how the taxes are imposed, it's not imposed on the organization itself. It's primarily imposed on this disqualified person insider. So what is an excess benefit transaction? Well, it's one where an economic benefit is provided by a tax-exempt organization to a disqualified person, and the value of the economic benefit provided to the disqualified person actually exceeds the value of the consideration that the disqualified person provided to the tax-exempt organization in return. So who are these people who are disqualified persons? Well, it's anyone who currently or in the past 5 years, ending on the date of the transaction, was in a position to exercise substantial influence over the affairs of the organization as a whole. It also includes family members of those people, as well as entities that are more than 35% controlled by those people. Whether someone has substantial influence is primarily a facts and circumstances determination, but there is a de facto group of disqualified persons in the regulations. So voting trustees or voting directors, board members are always going to be disqualified persons. The CEO or president, the COO or functional equivalent, and the CFO or functional equivalent are de facto disqualified persons. Also, it's generally considered that if someone meets the test for key employee status on the Form 990, the IRS Form 990, that's probably a pretty good indicator that that person is a disqualified person based on the definitions and the overlap with the regulations. So what are some examples of excess benefit transactions? Most commonly, it's when someone is overpaid for services, so unreasonable compensation. It could also arise in the context of an asset purchase or sale, or services are provided by a disqualified person or an entity controlled by disqualified persons, where the tax-exempt organization overpays, or in a transaction where property is sold, where the tax-exempt organization overpays, or if there's an underpayment going in the other direction. So any transactions that involve insiders to the organization really need to be flagged for potential intermediate sanctions concerns. Now, there's a very helpful procedure set forth in the IRS regulations that if it's followed, it creates a rebuttable presumption that a transaction is reasonable so that there isn't an excess benefit transaction. It can be rebutted by the IRS, but it sort of shifts the burden of proof to the IRS to show that it's unreasonable, because the default expectation is that it's reasonable if this process is followed. It's quite straightforward, and we recommend it certainly for executive compensation arrangements with the top people at an organization. So the arrangement needs to be approved in advance by disinterested members of a board or committee, so people who don't have a conflict of interest with respect to the arrangement that's being reviewed. The committee or the board needs to rely on comparability data when it's making its decision. So that could be a compensation study. It could be information about comparable compensation for similar positions that is obtained from looking at IRS Forms 990. It could be if it's a property sale. It could be a third-party valuation, something along those lines, but comparability data needs to be reviewed. And then the board or committee needs to document the process in minutes, and the regulations set forth what needs to be in the minutes. So common footfalls with trying to get into this safe harbor and failing: not enough documentation, they didn't get good comparability data. The wrong group reviews the comparability data. So it has to be the group that actually has authority to approve the actual arrangement. So the one thing that happens a lot is the compensation committee is reviewing all of this information and doing a great job and getting all of the data and looking at it. And then they make their recommendation for the CEO's compensation to the full board, which is required to approve it. And the full board just takes the recommendation. That does not satisfy the safe harbor procedure because it needs to be undertaken by the body that actually has the authority to approve the arrangement. Another common footfall, the approval wasn't done in advance. So the employment agreement is signed and then everybody decides, oh, well, let's run it through this procedure and look at the data and affirm it. That's great. I mean, it's better than nothing, but it doesn't establish this rebuttable presumption of reasonableness. And then the last common footfall that springs to mind is not considering all elements of a compensation arrangement. So very clear in the IRS rules that total compensation needs to be considered in assessing reasonableness for intermediate sanctions purposes. So it's not just base salary or bonus. It's base salary, bonus, all the benefits, a deferred compensation arrangement, severance. All of those elements of compensation need to be considered in assessing reasonableness. Last excise tax we'll talk about today is a newer one, Section 4960 of the code, which imposes an excise tax at the corporate rate, currently 21%, on compensation arrangements that are more than $1 million. So the tax is imposed on the amount above $1 million and on what are called excess parachute payments. This tax applies to a group of people who are called covered employees of a tax-exempt organization. That includes the five highest compensated employees for the current year, but it also includes anyone who was on that list in a prior year, starting when this tax was enacted. So it's once a covered employee, always a covered employee. You might dip below the comp threshold in a particular year, but you still remain a covered employee in the event your compensation goes above in a future year. Remuneration that's included in determining whether there's an excess payment includes wages, vested deferred compensation under Section 457F, even if it hasn't been paid. Interestingly, there's an exclusion for payments made to licensed medical professionals for performance of medical services. It also applies to veterinary professionals. So that's a very helpful point for hospitals who are paying executives for both medical services and executive services sometimes. Importantly, related entity compensation is swept into the calculation of remuneration for purposes of this tax. So it's done based on a greater than 50% control test, and it includes even taxable entities. It also includes supporting organizations and supported organizations. But it's very important because in a system that has a lot of different entities where someone is an employee of the tax-exempt organization and is also performing services for another entity, you can unwittingly get caught in this tax because the amounts of compensation do need to be aggregated. And the tax is borne pro rata by the different entities that pay the individual. As I mentioned earlier, this doesn't just apply to the compensation in excess of $1 million, but also to what are called excess parachute payments. So these are generally severance payments. The basic rule is if the severance payment is greater than 3 times base salary, then you have an excess parachute payment that is subject to this excise tax. Importantly, the intermediate sanctions rules just talked about applies sort of side by side with this, just because this 4960 excise tax imposed, it doesn't mean you necessarily have an intermediate sanctions problem. It doesn't make compensation unreasonable. It's just an additional excise tax. And there are very specific regulations on this tax, and how to calculate it and how to figure out if you have a related organization and what are the exceptions that were released a couple of years ago that you should definitely consult if it is something that is applicable for the organization you're advising. So I think we have reached our final slide. So I will stop sharing and see if we have any Q&A. I don't think we do, but if people have questions, feel free to put them into the Q&A and we'll hold on for a couple minutes. Well, I'm going to assume that no one is madly typing at this moment.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, when I think of all of these taxes, I just think about planning. There's nothing wrong with having unrelated business income tax. It's just proper planning and assessing and knowing the costs associated with the taxes and building them in to the organization's operation. I'll say that on you, but I won't say that on some of the excise taxes, though. Right. I take it back. Exactly. Not all taxes, but those should be avoided.
Yep. Absolutely.
We've got one question about ads in magazines. What about ad books?
Meaning ads in books? Or what are ad books? I do not know what that means.
And I mean, I guess not to get all philosophical, what is an ad? I think is the question. It might be just a way to address that big picture. What's advertising? What's sponsorship? And how does that, I mean, this goes into planning, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you have a publication where you put it out to vendors or anyone else as to whether they want to have space in the publication. There is a distinction between advertising and, as Aaron said, sponsorship. Yes, fundraising ad books. So this is exactly, this is what the person asking the question is getting at. So you might have an event, right, where there is a publication that lists all of the donors to the event and lists what the program for the event is, but also includes sort of little boxes with the names of sponsors. And this gets into the difference between advertising and sponsorship. So generally, if you have what's called a qualified sponsorship payment, that is not considered UBTI. So there is a specific set of regulations that go through what is a qualified sponsorship payment. But the broad brush is that a sponsorship payment is one where the party who is making the payment is receiving a mere acknowledgement in return for the payment, as opposed to advertising. So, the symphony thanks XYZ Tires for sponsoring this event and puts the logo of the organization in the book with that text versus an actual ad for XYZ Tires that basically says, we're XYZ Tires. We have the best tires in town. Come to our location at address, call us at phone number. Here's our website. That would be an example of the difference between a non-taxable sponsorship and an ad.
Yep. And I'll just note, if you get an ad when you're soliciting for these types of books, a lot of times organizations, companies are amendable to just the sponsorship. So don't feel like you can't ask to say, hey, can we just put an acknowledgement on and remove some of the more quantitative, qualitative organization information? So because they're just looking mostly to support probably you and be associated with your mission.
Exactly.
I think that's it.
All right. Well, we're at 4 o'clock. Thank you all for joining. As we mentioned at the outset, the slides will be sent around to everyone who attended today. And thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good day.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.